If we take up our Bibles and turn to Mark chapter 10, and Gary, thank you very much, is going to come and read to us. Thank you, Gary.
This morning's reading is Mark chapter 10, starting at verse 32, which is page 1015 in the Church Bible. They were on their way up to Jerusalem, with Jesus leading the way, and the disciples were astonished, while those who followed were afraid. Again, he took the 12 aside and told them what was going to happen to him. "We are going up to Jerusalem," he said, "and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise." Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. "Teacher," they said, "we want you to do for us whatever we ask." "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. They replied, "Let one of us sit at your right and the other on your left in your glory." "You don't know what you are asking," Jesus said. "Can you drink the cup I drink, or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will drink the cup I drink, and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. But to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared." When the 10 heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many."
Well, set in London and revolutionary Paris is Charles Dickens' Tale of Two Cities, where Charles Darnay is facing the guillotine. And his lawyer's assistant, Sidney Carton, is the spitting image of Darnay. And Sidney decides to give his life in his place. He does this so Charles Darnay and his wife Lucy can be together. He manages to get into the prison. He drugs Charles Darnay. He changes clothes with him. He fools the guards. And next morning, it's him that is led away on the cart to execution. As the wheels rumble over the cobbles, he says, "It is a far, far better thing I do than I've ever done. A far, far better rest I go than I've ever known." It's obviously a very moving story of substitution. One of many wonderful stories which find their roots in the wonderful substitution story, the far, 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 far greater thing that Jesus has done for us. Why did Jesus come? Why do Christians join him on the road of suffering? Why do we deny self? Why do we get low? Why do we get chopping off sin? Why do we view our riches differently, hold our money, our things loosely, and be generous with them? Because Jesus' life transforms the lives of his followers. Because our Saviour came to serve us. He gave his life that we might receive pardon. He drank the cup that we might drink the cup of salvation. He paid the ransom that we may go free. We serve because Jesus served us. What a Savior we have, who alone is able to transform our relationship with our own will, our sin, our status problems, our spondulis, sorry, our wallets, our service of others. Last week, the rich man was the focus, the rich young ruler. Today, the focus is firmly on another rich man, but one who became poor, that we might become rich. So how did Jesus serve us? Well, firstly, he gave his life. He gave his life. In verse 32, the disciples are astonished and others are afraid as Jesus goes ahead of them to Jerusalem. Are they amazed at his speed? They're like, well, look at him, he's like clocking it, isn't he? You know, he's got some power walking ability on him. Are they amazed because he's just amazing at his pace? He's ahead of them. No, they're fearful. They're astonished because Jesus is leading the way to the place of trouble, isn't he? To the very place of danger. He is walking to the lion's den, if you like. So the disciples are astounded by this. Why is he going there? It's like, don't go there, Jesus. They hate you there. They will kill you in Jerusalem. You'll be dead if you go there, and so might we. So Jesus tells them again, doesn't he? And this is the third time now, in just a couple of chapters. We're going to Jerusalem. The Son of Man will be delivered over. He'll be condemned. He'll be mocked. He'll be spat upon. He'll be flogged. He'll be killed. And 3 days later, he will rise. We talk, don't we, about how the Romans put Jesus on the cross. But mainly, perhaps it was the Jews mainly that put Jesus on the cross. And actually, we think, no, of course, it was us. It was our sin that put Jesus on the cross. And while all those three are true, of course, actually, it's Jesus himself who put himself on the cross. He went there of his own accord, didn't he? No one takes my life from me, Jesus says. I lay it down of my own accord. So Jerusalem, seriously, Jesus, Jerusalem, go anywhere, but don't go to Jerusalem. But no, says Jesus, that's the one place I really need to go. And never has there been, or will there be, such an act of service. It's not that people haven't died for people in history. It happens quite a lot. But this is the Son of Man. This is the divine of Daniel, isn't it? The one who, with dominion, shares with dominion with the Ancient of Days. He's coming to serve. When it's our role to serve, it's expected, isn't it? So I got a little university holiday job at Epsom Racecourse. I was there at Epsom Racecourse to serve. I had my black sack and my litter picker thing. That's what I was there for. I was there to serve. The Queen was there as well. She was just behind, up a few balconies in her stand. I was expected to serve. That's why I was there. She wasn't. She had bodyguards. She was served by waiters. She had a soft chair, binoculars. She even had a few horses. But Jesus, the eternal, holy, creator God, think a billion times more than the Queen and beyond, whom all people, all nations, tribes and tongues should serve him, he came to serve. He came to give his life. I mean, what God becomes an ant? And not an ant to lead the other ants, but an ant to serve the ants. And not for a day or an afternoon like some kind of undercover reality TV show, you know, where the managing director spends the day kind of incognito on the factory floor. Not like Prince William, who spent a night sleeping with the homeless and with his minders, of course, as well, in the London Waterloo underpass. But Jesus got into the muck and the mess of this world for his whole life, didn't he? Not for an afternoon, not till he'd had enough and thought, you know, it's a bit hard work, this being human lark, but for his life. Without recognition, without payback. Incredible service, isn't it? To serve unrecognized for so long. In fairy stories, Cinderella, initially she's overlooked. She gets recognized there, doesn't she? The beast is seen as the dude he is, eventually. It all gets corrected. It's kind of, yay, the frog is actually a prince. But for his whole life, Jesus wasn't recognized. Right up until kind of the last 40 days, really. It's one thing to serve and be humble for a night or an afternoon, but to spend your whole life with nobody knowing who you really are, with no payback, that is incredible. Remarkable service, isn't it? I think probably the closest we have to it are mums. Mums give and give, don't they? They give behind the scenes, mostly unappreciated, mostly without anyone other than other mums knowing how much they give of themselves. The Son of Man came to serve. He gave his life. Secondly, he drank the cup. In verse 38, Jesus talks about a cup he will drink. I'm not going to say too much on this. It's going to be our focus in communion this afternoon. But the cup is close. The first Easter is around the corner. And in the garden, the cup is imminent, isn't it? And so Jesus falls to the ground, praying, Father, if possible, take this cup from me. The cup is used figuratively throughout the Bible. Psalm 16 and 116. It's a good cup. It's like the overflowing cup of God's goodness and love of Psalm 23. The cup, you kind of want to be filled more. But often, the cup is the cup of death. It's the cup of God's wrath. Isaiah 51, it's a cup of staggering. Jeremiah 25, a cup that makes the evil fall to rise no more. And then in Psalm 75, it's most vivid. In the hand of the Lord, there is a cup full of foaming wine mixed with spices which God pours out on all the wicked of the earth. Drink it down to the dregs. This is the cup of God's just anger and judgment at sin. It's the cup of punishment destined for all rebels, sinners, for the glory hunters of this earth. Jesus comes to serve by drinking the cup, that cup. It will overwhelm him. It's a baptism he talks about. It will engulf him like a baptism. That's why the gospel writers primarily, in their crucifixion accounts, they primarily point us not to the physical pain of the ordeal, but the unseen goings on. Because the Lord is making the punishment fall on him, the punishment all of us deserve. He served us, he gave his life, he drank the cup, and thirdly, paid the ransom. Depending on your upbringing, ransom might conjure up kidnapping in a Wild West film or a hostage crisis, where it means exactly as we know it to mean today through kind of Somalian pirates or South American drug gangs, is those who demand a price for the release of another. But of course, if Jesus is paying a ransom, who needs releasing? Who's captured? But Jesus says, John chapter 8, all who sin are slaves to sin. And it's sin that leaves us trapped. And we have a clear picture of sin in our passage. See, the disciples' reaction to Jesus' third death and resurrection prediction in verse 35 is an absolute classic. I mean, it's terrible, really. I mean, they're amazed he's heading to Jerusalem. Jesus has just said he will die in a horrible way. And the next moment, James and John want Jesus to reserve them the best seats in glory. And the rest get shirty about it, don't they? You know, probably because they're jealous. Maybe they're annoyed with themselves because they didn't get in there first. And we had this arguing about who's the greatest back in chapter 9. Jesus' horrible announcement should have a sobering effect, like cause for pause, reflect, deep thinking. The road is tough. To follow is hard, self-denial, self-sacrifice. But instead, what's going on in them is this desire for self-glory, isn't it? That's being stirred again in them. Nothing about what Jesus will go through. Instead, they talk about what they can get. It's incredible. Verse 35, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. And if you look across to verse 51, there's a striking comparison to be made. So the disciples want places of status. We want you to do what we ask. Well, Bartimaeus, Jesus says, what do you want me to do for you? Bartimaeus wants to see. That's a very good question to ask ourselves, isn't it? What do we want from Jesus? If we're honest, we could ask Jesus to do something for us, anything. What would it be? I think the harsh truth is we tend to be more like the disciples than the blind man. Especially in our humanity. We're not Christians. We're more like the disciples than the blind man. So they say, we want you to grant us to sit either side of you in glory. Jesus says, I'm going to be delivered over. And they say, we want seats in the cabinet. I'm going to Jerusalem to die. And they say, well, when you settle in at number 10, number 11 will be fine for us. It's sin. It's sin of self, isn't it? And here's the reason ransom is needed. Because their sin is such that in a sense they can't, in a sense, help their reaction to Jesus. They're guilty for it. But such is the hard wiring of the human heart that is only selfish all the time, desperately wicked. They're locked into a mindset of sin, stuck in their sin. Because sin does that, doesn't it? It captures, it enslaves. That's what sin does. I remember the kind of retort at school. I might be alone here, probably not, hopefully not. When asking someone, for example, if you want to play football, can you, mind get off our little football area, please? The comeback sometimes is like, nah, free country, that kind of thing. I don't know, I heard the word free country quite a lot. Are we free, though? Are we free? It's a big question. Do we have free will? Or are we prisoners? Well, most would say, yes, we're free to choose. We do what we like. Go here, go there. But here's the thing. We're only free within the confines of our will. And that's exactly the problem for the sinner. The will is only free within its own sinful nature. Genesis 6, God looked down and saw that every intention of the thought of human heart was wicked all the time. This book, Born Slaves, Grace Essentials, essential book. Born Slaves, The Bondage of the Will is the excellent title of Luther's book. It's still Reformation year, you can wave this around, is it? Yeah. Might have some spares. If you want to borrow it, feel free. Otherwise, we can get you one. And they've done a pretty good job in this book of making it easier to read as well. And Luther, in this book, explains the Bible's teaching on free will and sin by explaining that far from being free, apart from Jesus, without Jesus, actually we're caged. We're in a prison in our thinking, intentions and motives, because they are locked into a heart that is fundamentally sinful. So we have free will, but only to act out of the captive hearts we have, which means sinful man is not free. Not free to love God, to respond, but rather can only choose out of the sinful nature. A release is needed. A ransom, because the sinner is captured, slave to sin, imprisoned in a sinful will. Romans 3 verse 10 is an echo of Genesis chapter 6. No one is righteous. No one seeks God, does good, not even one. But back to Genesis 6, the comeback can be, but Noah, He was good, wasn't he? That's why he was put on the ark. Well, Noah was righteous because Genesis 6 verse 8, he found favor in the eyes of the Lord. John 3 verse 6, that which is born of flesh, sin, is flesh, sin. That is what it is. That's not the spirit, is it? We can't be spirit without rebirth. And Paul says in Galatians 3, the sinner's will is so captive, it doesn't even know what sin is. And the law is good because it reveals sin. So Paul says in Romans 7, I wouldn't know what coveting was if the law hadn't told me. Grant us to sit either side of you in glory. It's another example of the captivity of sin, which desperately requires a ransom. Sinners needing to be set free. Let's think for a minute. Who is this ransom paid to? Sin came into the world through the devil. So some have supposed that the ransom for release from sin is to the devil, to the one who keeps us in captivity, in a sense. That's why in the Narnia series, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, particularly the White Witch, says that Edmund's sin of betrayal leaves him in debt to her. She says she's due a payment of blood. His life is forfeit to me. But biblically, that's wrong. Our sin does not leave us in debt to the devil. Tricked by the devil, yes. But our sin leaves us facing the penalty of God's wrath at our sin. The debt, the ransom is owed to God. Now there's no mention of Satan near the cross. The last mention of him is when Jesus says to Peter, get behind me, Satan. Because Satan does not want the ransom to be paid. He wants captives kept as captive. That's why he tries to keep Jesus from the cross. The ransom is to the Father. It's he who's wronged by our sin. The glory, the praise, the honor, the greatness is all rightfully his. So it's he who in his purity and his holiness, in his just wrath, will punish and remove sin. Think of sin a bit like that of an internet shopping addict who builds up this huge debt online. And then they run out of money. So hack into other people's accounts and start spending their money. And then they're finally caught and they stand in the dock and they have this huge millions and million pounds of debt. So big, they cannot pay it back and they're facing punishment. But the debt of our sin is caused, it's similarly overwhelming. What can hold back God's just punishment of our sin? What can be paid to God that will turn his wrath away? What can alter the sinner's path from collision course with God's just wrath at sin? It's a redeemer, isn't it? One who can pay the price of sin. One who can buy us out. And Jesus served by paying the ransom. He atones by substitution, by paying for sin with his own life. Now, penal substitution, penal meaning penalty, is something a lot of people don't like to talk about. And sadly, including in Christian circles, most infamously by Steve Chalk. Say, penal substitution, no, it makes God seem angry. Well, God is angry. God is angry at sin. But they say, well, how could the Father punish his own son? That's just cosmic child abuse. That's not nice. But the disciples were astonished because Jesus is heading to Jerusalem. And Isaiah 53, it was the Lord's will to crush him, to cause him to suffer. The Father and the Son are one, aren't they? Perfect in unity, perfect in purpose. He walks to Jerusalem to drink the cup. The Father pours it out on him. He gives his life as a ransom. The Father receives the payment. He is cut off for sin, but not his own. The great redeeming work is done by the Godhead, isn't it? John Stott says, God satisfied himself by substituting himself for us. The Father sends. The Son gets bruised. The Spirit opens our eyes to see. Enables us to cry, Abba, Father. Mark 10, verse 45 is the gospel. It's the gospel. One of the clearest places to find the gospel. Jesus came to serve us, to free us from the punishment our sin deserves, from the power of sin now, to free us to love God, to free us to respond, to free us to serve back, to become like Christ. He serves. So how much more should we? And verse 43, we had this again in the previous passage. He basically says, verse 43, greatness is serving. They've got the mindset problem of the Gentiles. Greatness is to be in charge, to lord it over. No, Jesus says. Verse 43, instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. But before we get serving, we must see that our sin of me first makes it impossible for us to serve like Jesus. What gets in the way of us serving one another is us, isn't it? It's our desire for greatness, like the disciples in the passage. How can we serve like Jesus? I mean, we can't in the same way. Only he can give his life in that way. But how can we serve one another? Well, we can't. Here's a little chart. I quite like little charts. It's not a particularly good one. It's not particularly clear either. But the command is be a servant, be a slave, be last. There you go. That's the command. But the middle is the problem. Well, our sin, that's impossible for us to put ourselves last. But lastly, Jesus' ransom enables us to serve. So it comes back round. It's made possible for us to be a servant, to be last. In order for us to serve others like Jesus, we first need to be served by Jesus, who served us by giving his life, drinking the cup, paying the ransom. That act of service enables us to obey verse 43. So let me ask this morning, have you personally been served by Jesus? Has he paid the ransom for you? Or are you left with the unthinkable prospect of paying for your own sin? If that is the case, let me plead you do not delay. Grace flows downhill. It flows from the cross. Come to Jesus on your knees. Come to him like blind Bartimaeus. I want to see. That's what I want. I want to understand. I want to see. Christians here this morning, how is our service of the Lord? How is our service of one another? Well, if it's weak, and it is weak at times, often, isn't it? If so, it's often because our grasp of Jesus' service for us is weak. So let's seek to further grasp the gospel. Now, there's no doubt amongst us here that some of us need to get serving more. We're too self-serving. We need to be active in this. But there are some here that sort of have the opposite problem, that we actually find it hard to let others serve us. We must all first be served by Jesus. We must serve others, but we also must let others serve us. If we don't let others serve us, we're actually restricting others from serving. And some of us serve so much and need to hear this. We need to hear that it's vital that we too are served. Jesus came to serve, to do a far, far better thing we could ever imagine. Far, far better than anything this world has ever known. On the back of the notices, there's a little verse to learn. Again, let me encourage you to learn Bible verses. Just put it somewhere where you can see it morning and evening, by your bed works, and just read it. By the end of the week, you'll have learned it probably. Verse 43, maybe if you feel this sort of your serving issue in you that you need to serve more, or 45, whichever. A prayer to pray, a song to sing. We sung the Servant King. Look and See the Village Church on YouTube. It's a good song as well. Let me encourage you, in the week, not Sundays only, in the week, get into God's Word. Get on your knees in prayer. Seek Him.